attacks, intimidation and harassment against Muslims, immigrants, African Americans, women, and people of color. The most commonly reported place where physical or verbal harassment occurred continues to be in K-12 schools. A for-profit immigrant family detention center in Karnes County, Texas, has banned migrant children held there from having access to crayons while their mothers meet with lawyers. Immigration authorities claim the ban is a response to children coloring on a table in the prison's visiting area, which, quote, caused damage to the contractor, unquote. The facility is operated by the private prison company Geo Group, which saw its stock price jump after Donald Trump won the presidential election. Human rights advocates are calling for the Obama administration to cut ties with the private prison industry and end family detention before the close of his term. And writer Colson Whitehead has won the National Book Award for The Underground Railroad, a novel about a young enslaved girl who escapes from a Georgia plantation. At the New York City Awards ceremony, Whitehead said, quote, "We're happy in here. Outside is the blasted hellhole wasteland of Trumpland. Be kind to everybody. Make art and fight the power," unquote. And in this breaking news, the Washington Post is reporting that Donald Trump has chosen Kansas Congressman Mike Pompeo as CIA director. Pompeo's opposed closing Guantanamo Bay Prison. In 2013, he visited the notorious U.S. prison and said of the prisoners who were on hunger strike, quote, "It looked to me like a lot of them had put on weight," unquote. Pompeo also is a vocal opponent of the Iran nuclear deal. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We are broadcasting from the COP22 here in Marrakesh, Morocco. In what's seen by some as a direct response to the election of Donald Trump and his rejection of climate science, nearly 200 nations have agreed on a proclamation here in Marrakech, Morocco, declaring implementation of the Paris Climate Accord to be a, quote, urgent duty. This comes just over a week after Trump was elected president. He's vowed to pull the United States out of the Paris Agreement and has called climate change a Chinese-created hoax. Trump will soon become the only world leader who doesn't believe in climate change. This is Aziz Makhour, Morocco's head negotiator at the talks.
We call for all parties to strengthen and support efforts to eradicate poverty, ensure food security, and to take stringent action to deal with climate change challenges in agriculture. We call for urgently raising ambition and strengthening cooperation amongst ourselves to close the gap between current emissions trajectories and the pathway needed to meet the long-term temperature goals of the Paris Agreement. We call for an increase in the volume, flow, and access to finance for climate projects alongside improved capacity and technology, including from developed to developing countries. We, the developed countries, reaffirm our $100 billion mobilization goal. We unanimously call for further climate action and support well in advance of 2020, taking into account the specific needs and special circumstances of developing countries, the least developed countries, and those particularly vulnerable to the adverse impacts of climate change. We who are parties to the Kyoto Protocol encourage the ratification of the Doha Amendment.
That's Aziz Makhour, Morocco's head negotiator at the COP22 talks, speaking after nations signed onto what's known as the Marrakesh Action Proclamation. Tina Johnson is policy director at the U.S. Climate Action Network.
And so it just became a signifying opportunity and moment for this COP to say that, you know, no one country, no one man, no one person can control the outcome of the destiny that we all see as part of the writing on the wall, that climate change is real, we need to act, and that we're going to do everything we can. So, yeah, I definitely think that the speeches over the last several days had that impact and effect on us as a civil society and over other countries as well.
Earlier this week, Frank Bainimarama, the Prime Minister of Fiji, appealed directly to President-elect Donald Trump.
I want to make a special appeal to the President-elect of the United States, Donald Trump, for a personal change of heart and a public change of policy on the issue of climate change. Sir, you have said that you do not believe that climate change is man-made, and you intend, as president, to cut off America's contribution to the global efforts to reduce carbon emissions. I am especially alarmed by reports that you intend to withdraw from the Paris Agreement, which would be disastrous for every person on Earth. I appeal to you to show the leadership that the rest of the world expects the United States to take on this issue. Please take another look at the overwhelming scientific consensus on the man-made effects of global warming. Please come as a matter of urgency to see for yourself the devastating impact that rising sea levels and extreme weather events are already having on our peoples and our way of life. President-elect Trump, I formally invite you to Fiji and promise you the warmest of welcomes. We will show you how we are already having to move entire communities out of the way of the rising seas. And you can meet the families of the 44 Fijians who were killed last February by the biggest tropical cyclone ever to make landfall in the southern hemisphere. I repeat, the world looks to America for leadership as we work together to confront this challenge to our survival and the well-being of our planet. President-elect Trump, I appeal to you, for humanity's sake, to show that leadership and to join our common cause. I thank you.
That's the Prime Minister of Fiji, Frank Bainimarama. He will be the president of the next COP, which won't be held in Fiji. It'll be held in Bonn, Germany. Meanwhile, climate activists have staged a series of actions here at the UN summit, calling on world leaders to do more to address the climate crisis.
My name is Winona Casino, and I'm from the Marshall Islands. This is in the North Pacific. Right now, my people are the front line. We are affected by climate change. We're feeling it right now. The island is barely 2 meters above sea level. I'm speaking to you as a mother. I have two babies. Where will we go if our island sinks?
On Thursday, climate activists also staged protests here targeting corporate sponsors of the UN Climate Summit. They began by staging a die-in at the UN Climate Summit inside a pavilion sponsored by the Moroccan phosphate giant OCP. The action was led by the Indigenous Youth Caucus and Sustain Us to raise awareness about the economic and health impacts of the company's phosphates plant in the coastal Moroccan town of Safi. Protesters then moved on to occupy the booth of the Moroccan mining company, Managem, a Moroccan mining company which runs a massive silver mine that's been the target of protests for years by the indigenous Amzir people of Amidar.
This action symbolizes indigenous and non-indigenous groups from both inside and outside of Morocco coming together to show the similarities of environmental atrocities communities around the world face. We wish to show how corporate sponsors of the COP contribute to greenwashing while ignoring environmental racism and classism. At the same time, people who live in these corporate sacrifice zones sadly pay with their lives and livelihoods without ever experiencing the privilege to walk into this space and draw attention to the injustices committed against them.
Yate, I come from the Navajo Nation, and I have been a standing rock while we were attacked by dogs and attacked with pepper spray. And since we are here in Morocco, and we are guests to the people here, we thought it would be appropriate that we draw attention to the corporate sponsors, OCP and Managem, who are also causing similar atrocities not far from where the COP is right now. For example, in SB, where we are actively polluting streams and rivers and oceans, where there used to be fishing opportunities for the people who drop dead in the streets because they can't breathe the air. Or forever here at Imidare, where our brothers and sisters have been occupying a space 300 kilometers south of COP22 because they are having their water drained in order to produce silver for an outside company, Managem. We would like everybody to please think of those people and think of their sovereignty and think of their rights as they are sacrifice zones to corporate greed.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back from break, we'll look at an issue that has barely received coverage here, the Moroccan occupation of the Western Sahara, which many consider to be Africa's last colony. Stay with us. Musicians playing during a demonstration here at the COP22 UN Climate Summit. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Marrakesh, Morocco. Here at the UN Climate Talks, one issue that's being largely ignored is Morocco's more than 41-year occupation of Western Sahara, located south of Morocco. Many consider it to be Africa's last colony. Last week, Moroccan authorities barred the Sahrawi political leader, Swelma Berukh, from attending the climate summit, even though she serves as the vice president of the Pan-African Parliament. She was reportedly held by Moroccan police for 75 hours without food or water. Morocco also faced criticism after it briefly published a map on an official COP22 website that showed occupied Western Sahara to be a part of Morocco. The image was later taken down from that website. The UN considers Western Sahara to be a non-self-governing territory. In March, Morocco expelled UN staffers from Western Sahara after UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon referred to Morocco's rule over the region as an occupation during a visit to the Algerian town of Tindouf, which has been the home for Western Saharan refugees for four decades. One half of the Sahrawi population lives in the refugee camps, while the other half lives in the territory under occupation. Moroccan authorities also continue to block many international journalists and human rights organizations from entering the occupied Western Sahara. This week, I spoke to the British-based Algerian activist Hamza Hamouchine, who serves as the senior program officer for North Africa and West Asia at the British organization War on Want.
So I'm here for the COP to organize events around the COP22, but I'm not participating officially for the COP22. So we organize different events to be in solidarity with communities that are being affected by environmental injustices, by the neoliberal policies of the Moroccan monarchy. And I have attempted to travel to the occupied territories of Western Sahara 2 days ago, and I have been denied entry.
What happened? Where did you go, and how were you stopped?
So I started my journey from a southern town in Morocco called...
Thanks for listening to Free Radio. You can catch Free Radio at freakradio.org or 101.3 FM.
De ellos en Santa Cruz, pero es en inglés, que lástima para los que hablan español, pero... Es mi problema, no hablo mucho español, entonces I will speak in English because my Spanish is limited. This is Bathrop's Piers Broadsides, the September 29th, 2010 edition coming up, so stay tuned. We're going to have a special guest, Melody, at 7, doing some singing, I believe. And we're going to have the verdict in the Facer Norse case, long delayed and finally played, as well as... A audio replay of curb hugger Chris Doyon's. Yeah.
Going out to all my shorties. What's up, boys and girls? Holla back from the North Pole. I hope you have been good or you will get a lump of coal. It's the time of year when Christmas presents are the thing. Oh, snap, I come to your crib and drop a bling bling. I got the fattest piece to get your toes tapped in. Check it out while I roll out my Christmas wrapping. I got tired of my sleigh, so I have an upgrade. I'm delivering your presents in a pimped out Escalade. 24-inch thinner stereo makes windows break. You will know Santa's coming when your house begins to shake. Clap the screens in the back, smells like frankincense and myrrh. Thanks to Rudolph, all the seats are trimmed in reindeer fur. When I come to your house, won't use the chimney. Don't want to ruin my suit because it cost me 15 G's. Underneath the tree, I leave toys and Xboxes. Victoria's Secret for the finest of biatches. Don't want no giant cookie or a glass of milk that's tall. Just leave me a fatty with a magnum of crystal.
Can you hear me?
So it's back to the North Pole. This flying makes me dizzy. Now Santa needs a present with the missus all get busy. I'm gonna get my freak on. I know it may sound shocking. Cause Kringle's feeling naughty. Gonna stuff more than a stocking. Mrs. Claus is the finest woman you will ever know. She's three times a lady. She's my ho, ho, ho.
I see.
Merry Christmas. Peace. Best dog out.
And you're probably wondering what that was. Well, no, you weren't. It's actually the introduction to Bathrob Spears Broadsides from September 30th, 2010. And boy, it sounded like it was an interesting show. I'm interrupting it, though, because we're in 2016. It's 6 years later, more or less. And I guess I got to talk about what's going on now, though. Doesn't make me feel any more optimistic than then, but we got to go that we got to go. I'm also having problems here in the studio, and by the way, you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, the stream, but not the broadcast, at freakradio.org. As anybody listening probably knows, unless you're listening on the archives, which can be accessed on the Huff website. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and the website is Huff Santa Cruz, all one word, all small letters, .org, huffsantacruz.org. So the call-in number here, in case you want to fill the lonely 2 hours coming up, is 831-427-3772, 831-427-FRSC, Free Radio Santa Cruz, 427-3772. I guess for those of you who are kind of wondering what ever happened to Robert Facer, he's the fellow who Ed Fry, the attorney, defended. I think he was 63 years old, an Amish minister who slept outside and who was arrested, cited rather, for sleeping on his boat, which was beached. And he fought the sleeping ticket. But the courts kept stalling, at least that was Ed Fry's analysis. And so Ed and Huff started a protest outside the county building, right outside the courts, demanding justice for not just Robert Facer, but for all people being harassed under the sleeping ban. And for a month, and even longer if you count the time that activists who then moved to City Hall and spent another 2 months there, though they were a much smaller group, headed by Gary Johnson and for a while Chris Doyen, Kerbugger Chris, also known as Commander X, for his later work with Anonymous. They created a safe zone for sleeping, just as the Freedom Sleepers are now creating a safe zone, though only once a week. This 2010 protest, which was called Peace Camp 2010, went on nightly, and actually had the benefit of a porta-potty, not because the county or the city had some compassion or common sense about public sanitation, but rather because Ed Fry himself, out of his own pocket, actually I think he was assisted by Paul Lee, but he hauled the porta-potty down every night, had it in front of the courthouse and then in front of the city hall while the homeless folks slept outside, those who were engaging in the protest, and then took it away every day and parked it near his law office, no doubt to the disconcerting of his law partners or the folks who are also using his in the same building who are also attorneys. Attorneys are often not the most liberal group, high on their plateau of privilege, you know. But Ed was quite remarkable in that regard. I've had my differences with Ed since then, but his achievements, his struggle in this matter are a matter of record, and I want to tip my hat to him tonight as I remember hearing this broadcast or the beginnings of this 2010 broadcast that maybe I'll put it on for later tonight. It was put on as an earlier broadcast in case I didn't come in. We here at Free Radio have a lot of canned stuff these days, but a number of us are still struggling to do live broadcasts. I'm one of them. This is a live broadcast if you're listening to me on Thanksgiving night. And you're welcome to call in with your live reports. Again, the number is 427-3772, and I will answer the phone, and we'll talk. I've actually had a prior conversation with activists up in Marysville who are struggling with demolition of campgrounds there in very cold weather. It's getting cold down here, as you can feel if you step outside or look up the weather on your computer screen, and it's pretty nasty, and we're going to get a report from them. If I myself was hoping to give you a report, which I actually kind of wrote up, but I don't have access to the Internet tonight. It's apparently strange because I'm broadcasting to you on the Internet, or at least I think I am. Let's take a look here. Yeah, as I remember hearing this broadcast or the beginnings of this 2010 broadcast that maybe I'll put it on for later tonight. It was put on as an earlier broadcast in case I didn't come in. We here at Free Radio have a lot of canned stuff these days, but a number of us are still struggling to do live broadcasts. I'm one of them. This is a live broadcast if you're listening to me on Thanksgiving night. And you're welcome to call in with your live reports. Again, the number is 427-3772, and I will answer the phone, and we'll talk. I've actually had a prior conversation with activists up in Marysville who are struggling with demolition of campgrounds there in very cold weather. It's getting cold down here, as you can feel if you step outside or look up the weather on your computer screen, and it's pretty nasty, and we're going to get a report from them. If I myself was hoping to give you a report, which I actually kind of wrote up, but I don't have access to the Internet tonight. It's apparently strange because I'm broadcasting to you on the Internet, or at least I think I am. Let's take a look here. Yeah, as I remember hearing this broadcast or the beginnings of this 2010 broadcast that maybe I'll put it on for later tonight. It was put on as an earlier broadcast in case I didn't come in. We here at Free Radio have a lot of canned stuff these days, but a number of us are still struggling to do live broadcasts. I'm one of them. This is a live broadcast if you're listening to me on Thanksgiving night. And you're welcome to call in with your live reports. Again, the number is 427-3772, and I will answer the phone, and we'll talk. I've actually had a prior conversation with activists up in Marysville who are struggling with demolition of campgrounds there in very cold weather. It's getting cold down here, as you can feel if you step outside or look up the weather on your computer screen, and it's pretty nasty, and we're going to get a report from them. If I myself was hoping to give you a report, which I actually kind of wrote up, but I don't have access to the Internet tonight. It's apparently strange because I'm broadcasting to you on the Internet, or at least I think I am. Let's take a look here. Yeah, as I remember hearing this broadcast or the beginnings of this 2010 broadcast that maybe I'll put it on for later tonight. It was
It was put on as an earlier broadcast in case I didn't come in. We here at Free Radio have a lot of canned stuff these days. But a number of us are still struggling to do live broadcasts. I'm one of them. This is a live broadcast if you're listening to me on Thanksgiving night. And you're welcome to call in with your live reports. Again, the number is 427-3772. And I will answer the phone and we'll talk. I've actually had a prior conversation with activists up in Marysville who are struggling with demolition of campgrounds there in very cold weather. It's getting cold down here, as you can feel if you step outside or look up the weather on your computer screen. And it's pretty nasty. And we're going to get a report from them. If I myself was hoping to give you a report, which I actually kind of wrote up, but I don't have access to the internet tonight. It's apparently strange because I'm broadcasting to you on the internet, or at least I think I am. Let's take a look here. Yeah, the Winamp, when I pushed it, a little bar comes up, and yes, there it is. Quite right. It's back. So it looks like we're back online. We're probably broadcasting over the air with all this. So it looks like we're back here with Broadsides, Bathrope's Piers Broadsides again. And my apologies, we had a streaming computer problem, and now we may be in better shape. Hopefully we are. It looks like to some extent we are. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, the stream, and this name of the show is Bathrope's Piers Broadsides, if you just happen to check us out on your computer dial. It's difficulties tonight. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to launch pretty directly into... what am I going to launch into here? I'm going to launch into some earlier audio that I recorded days ago. It's actually been kind of an eventful week for those of you who like to follow such things. Such as the Santa Cruz Shitty Council, as I like to call it, which had a meeting on Tuesday, and sort of course, the aftermath of the Clinton debacle, or the Trump victory, or the business as usual, but a little more nativistic and racist sounding than your standard victory without the bells and whistles and respectability you normally come to associate with the hypocrisy of a pseudo-democratic process in the United States, and in Santa Cruz, for that matter. So, it's a little frustrating to begin the show 35 minutes late, but I'm going to kind of carry on as best I can, and I hope you forgive me. You can call in now. You can hear the show, hopefully, those of you who are patient enough to have not given up completely, which probably is most everybody, but maybe not. In any case, I will be broadcasting this show later as a sort of an additional bonus for those who have the savvy and the sustaining power to go on to the Huff website, which is where there are a lot of old shows already archived from the Bathrope Spears Broadsides history, which goes back 21 years now, long time. So, yeah, let's begin with a little quick something from Meriwether Mike, who's a man about Santa Cruz. Ran into him, I guess it was a couple weeks ago. Well, a week and a half ago, at the right after the Red Church. And he has a kind of a merry perspective on things. He always rides about town on a gaily decorated bike. He's a sort of archetypal, what you might imagine a hippie to be, if you're into that way of looking at people. Let's hear him.
I got nothing on the shelter. We're talking with Meriwether Mike, who probably has nothing more than I do, but you say that some people were somewhat dismayed to find there was no new information about winter shelter.
Well, we gave a quick review. Thanks for letting me share just real quickly on the forum that was held here Sunday. I'm thinking the article's in the paper, Scott's in the house.
Scott Steve, Galloway.
Right, and Steve Pleisch. Surely.
Yeah, get it straight.
Working on those names here. And, you know, we're grateful that everybody's doing all they know to do. We're not pointing blame any, you know, just...
Blame Trump and Matthews.
Yeah. We're just thinking, okay, we know there's plans in the works. It's just the information's not hitting the streets like I think it could be to...
Or maybe there's nothing in the works, and that's why their information isn't hitting the streets.
Well, yeah, just from the article and the little bit of feedback in person from Scott and Steve, I was sensing a
reluctance to talk about the issue.
Either a wait and see or it's all bad, so you don't want to hear it.
Get the fuck away from me so I don't have to embarrass myself.
Right. Who wants to share, like, no news or bad news, or is no news bad news? Sometimes no news is good news. I don't know.
Sometimes. When it has to do with police and the Rangers, yeah, often that's the case.
She's listening. Maybe you should ask her something.
I think I will.
I didn't know if she was annoyed at us or not. But
no, you're not annoyed at us, are you?
Oh, not at all.
Didn't think so.
Because they're having a show for free, a reality show.
We spoke earlier. And we've been talking with?
Meriwether Mike in the house with Bathrose Pierre and another local Rainbow Sister keeping it going in Santa Cruz.
And now let's take a jump up to Berkeley. And I've probably mentioned this on the air before, but Berkeley has been the site of a continuous homeless encampment called the Poor Tour. Originally, it was a protest against discrimination at the so-called hub, which is a sort of a centralized bureaucracy which has been essentially shutting down access to shelter services and other homeless services in Berkeley, according to activist Dan McMullen, who we had on the air. We've had him a couple times on the air talking. He's a member of one of the commissions up there. That they have apparently dozens of citizen commissions. Santa Cruz, of course, has been cutting back its commissions. We have far less here, not only than they have there, but than we used to have. And it's, the commissions meet less frequently, and they're ignored more pointedly. Although I haven't even been following what the commissions have been doing. There are a few big ones like the Downtown Commission, the Planning Commission, the Parks and Rec Commission. But, for example, the power of the Parks and Rec Commission to be able to, the requirement that the Parks and Rec Führer or boss go through the Parks and Rec Commission before major changes has essentially been, in some cases, removed. So, for instance, the Parks and Rec director can, on her or now his, since Dana Shoemaker resigned and we have a new director there, if he wants, he can rule any area in the city with the permission of the city manager, parks and rec area, even if it has nothing to do with parks or rec. So, for instance, that's why you see the Rangers on Pacific Avenue, even though there's obviously no park on Pacific Avenue and not much parking and no parking your butt if you're a poor and homeless person. But the Parks and Rec has the right to walk up and down there. Actually, that's explicitly part of the area outlined in Municipal Code 13.04. But anywhere in town, they can if the city manager authorizes them. That's Martine Bernal is the current city manager. probably city manager for life. That was the case with Dick Wilson, prior city manager, until he resigned, or retired, I guess it was. And actually, the city manager recently had a so-called performance evaluation, but that was all in closed session, you understand. There was no attempt to get real community input into the performance of the most powerful official in the city. I would encourage those of you, well, I don't know, I really wanted to do this. I had a very few brief words with incoming city council member Chris Krohn. He previously was a mayor almost 20 years ago, and he was also a council member for 4 years. And he was part of a sort of a so-called liberal team that was going to reform things, called themselves the Three Amigos, or the Three Caballeros, who were elected in 1998 in order to stop the destruction of the Beach Flats community. That was one of the main purposes, and also the Rotkin Kennedy Matthews Council. Kennedy's dead. Rotkin's currently not on the council, but Matthews is still mayor and was reelected last week. No, it was November 8th, something like that. So, in any case, the Berkeley Poor Tour, as it's now called, which began as a protest against the cutback in services in Berkeley, which wasn't really a cutback. I don't know that funding was cut back there, as was the complaint at our recent city council member about many services here. But it was rather the failure of the money that did reach the services to be able to get to homeless people, and the failure of homeless people to get the most basic kinds of services when they walked in. This protest began, and it's been going on for 6 or 7 weeks now, every night, at different places in the city as police move it around. When I went up there about a week and a half ago, thereabouts, I ran into the protest near City Hall, and I think we talked to Berkeley activist Carol Denny last show about this issue, and she kind of gave us a description. But a few days before I spoke with her in the last show, I did speak to the actual activists with the Poor Tour, and I'm going to play some of that now. You can also read about the Poor Tour in its earlier days in the last month's Street Spirit, which is actually it's the month before last Street Spirit. They began 6 weeks ago, so there was some of it was actually in the October issue of the Street Spirit, which is a monthly newspaper by and for homeless people, actually by the American Friends Service Committee, or people who work with it. And now I've been struggling to do it independently of the American Friends Service Committee, which has kind of cut off funding for it, if I understand correctly. Anyway, let's hear something from Poor Tour activists up there and from me as I interviewed them back on November 15th.
So up here at Alston and Milvia in Berkeley, there's a sign, Berkeley Homeless, and we have a variety of tents covered with tarps. I'm talking 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 tents of these. Got two folks. Hey, how's it going? I'm with Free Radio in Santa Cruz. Any reports from the street?
I met you before at the Red Church.
Wow, okay. Huh.
I don't remember your name, but I remember your face.
I'm Robert.
Robert, yes. I'm Harp.
Hey, Harp.
How you doing?
They just came through and censored our free speech.
I want to hear about that. We're talking with?
My name's Straps. I've been out here with this First I Came for the Homeless protest now for 3 weeks. 3 weeks? Yeah. We've had a bunch of cops roll up on us, and we're talking to Michelle in the back saying that they had to get rid of the suicidal artwork that was on the sidewalk.
Suicidal artwork? What
exactly? It was one of our campers basically had written a bunch of stuff saying it would be better off be dead than, be homeless.
Expressing his feelings.
Yeah, exactly. Expressing his feelings. Not to mention, I actually looked it up. California is actually an assisted suicide legal state. So there's something. So, yeah, so our political free speech was violated today. It's all the videos should be posted on Facebook already.
When did this happen? Of course, we're down here at about 2:20.
Probably about an hour ago they started.
It's about 1:15 or so.
And how long have you guys been here?
We've been at this spot for a week now, 4 days, 5 days.
About a week.
Yeah, about a week.
And did the infamous suicidal graffiti get removed?
It did, with a power washer unit, which I understand cost the city a lot of money. Interesting tidbit on that, the battery went dead while they were out here power washing.
What a coincidence.
And then they brought out one of those little jumpstart packs. Some idiot forgot to charge that one, so they had to bring a whole nother truck out.
Well, anything for the people.
Well, depends on the person, I guess.
Which people, I guess, is the question.
They also they seem to like taking a whole lot of pictures of me. I wonder if it's because I have a tendency of doing all the live streams out here.
It could be your attractive green hair.
I think the ladies may just have a thing for green hair punk girls, that's all.
What about your fancy boots?
These are some pretty fancy boots. I think they're a little jelly.
I'm not even mentioning your Eat the Rich sweatshirt hoodie.
Yeah, that's fun. Mm.
So how many folks are here? What's been happening? And what's up next? What's going on? Clue me in.
Well, what's up next? Nothing. We're sitting right here until they do something about giving us a better spot to camp. Because, I don't know, I like this spot.
They usually like to raid us at about 4:40 in the morning.
Yeah.
The last time that happened was?
About a week ago.
We were on the steps. They moved us to here.
And how long were you on the steps for?
We were on the stairs for the weekend. Funny, though, too, the stairs got covered in the blood of the homeless, and they brought out a power washer unit to take it out, and the blood of the homeless was just flowing down the street. Of course, that was red tempera paint.
And they also shorted out their circuits by the water getting into the building.
Because of the power washing.
Don't you see all the problems they're creating for the city administration?
I think they're causing their own problems. If they just leave us be, I don't think they'd have any problems.
So, how many folks would you estimate are here?
I don't know. Honestly, we keep growing every day. We're probably up to about 25, 30 at this point.
I counted, I'm not sure, 3, 6, 9, 10... 13 or 14 tents, maybe?
Yeah, there's a lot of people that are doubled up in tents. Like, we're doubled up in a tent, and then there's some other people that just don't have tents. So.
Are people having to provide their own tents, or are they tents
yeah,
being
yeah,
given?
Yeah, we get donations of tents. I bought my own, and I donated one, so.
Any connection with Oakland encampments?
Not that I'm aware of. We're obviously, I'm down with any of the encampments that are drug and alcohol free, but, yeah.
Is this drug and alcohol free?
Yeah.
How do you do that? What kind of enforcement mechanism?
Just kind of mutual, don't do it. You know what I mean? If we see anybody that comes through that looks kind of shady about it, it's kind of like tell them that it's drug and alcohol free. For the most part, people respect it.
Does that include marijuana?
No. Well, marijuana is a medicine, so no.
Well, only for very serious conditions, thanks to Proposition 64.
Well, yeah. Don't get me started on Proposition 64.
Actually, why don't you talk a little bit about it?
Proposition 64 kind of killed it for all the medical users, personally. I don't use it as medicine. I don't use it, period. But I know a lot of people out here that do use it as medicine. And it's like now the maximum weight they can carry is an ounce. Okay, you're living in a tent. Where are you supposed to put your grow? It's going to be more than an ounce if you get six plants.
You
know?
Can buy it at your local distributor's store in 2 years.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're better off growing.
You could go to Colorado and buy it, maybe.
No, transferring between state lines is a federal offense then.
What isn't a federal offense these days?
And, of course, it's also illegal to smoke your medical marijuana in public as well, as far as I know. Although, if somebody who's more of a legal scholar or patient reader than I am can read through Proposition 64 and its 64 or so odd pages, let me know. I got to admit, I never actually read through every single page. I got through about, I don't know, a third, two-thirds, a half, somewhere around there, and then gave up or just went on to other things, probably watching movies or something, but... Anyway, let's hear some more from the Poor Tour. And Straps, if I have her name right.
Is there much, you know, there's been a lot of brouhaha in Santa Cruz, as there is here, about the election of Führer Trump, who are, as our chief executive. Is there any, you think, movement in town to actually deal with real problems in Berkeley that's linked to this? Like, I don't know, I guess the rent control board is better than it was?
We had I guess a couple days ago, there was a group of about 100 or so UC Berkeley students came and spoke on the Civic Center, had a rally against Trump, and they were basically looking for immigrant rights. But they spoke in solidarity with us. That live stream's on Facebook, too.
And the new mayor, whose name I can never pronounce.
Jesse. Yeah, Jesse. Jesse's supposed to be for us. He's a lot more for us than the last guy. So we'll see what he actually does.
You mean Tom Bates?
Master Bates, yeah.
Master Bates, yes. Well, I knew there was something good about that phraseology. But is anything planned at the Berkeley shitty council meeting coming up?
Not that I'm aware of. I don't go to city council meetings. For some reason, they don't like how bored I get in there. I get a little mouthy when I get bored.
Indeed.
More fun that way.
Copwatch been involved here much? Do folks in the encampment have video cameras or cell phones with picture capability?
We all do. And Copwatch has been out here. Copwatch actually joined us when we got raided when we were up on Adeline at Fairview. And they actually got a lot of the video when Nancy Armstrong Temple was arrested.
I saw that online, and I understand. Is she still facing a trial for the resisting arrest charges?
It wasn't resisting arrest. They were actually charging her with lynching.
That's right. Wasn't she also charged with resisting arrest?
No, she was only charged with lynching. There was other people that were arrested for resisting arrest was their only charge, which I thought was funny. But all the charges, from what I've understood, have been dropped. I know the charges against Nancy Armstrong Temple have been dropped.
How are other homeless folks in the community responding to this particular, I guess, what do we call the encampment here?
It's an occupation right now. We're occupying, but, I mean, it's basically an encampment. It's more of a protest than anything.
And how do other people, you get positive response from homeless folks, negative, indifferent?
Most of this response has been positive. There's a lot of people who want to move in to our encampment, but we have to make sure, you know, personalities kind of commingle well, because we are a community. We're an intentional community. Beyond that, we have to make sure they're clean and sober, because, you know, we just don't want to bring those kind of issues into play.
Any other large encampments in Berkeley, or small encampments, whether clean and sober or dirty and drunken?
I know there are a bunch of people that sleep in the park over there, but from what I understand, they're not so clean or sober.
But they are trying to get some sleep.
I don't think they sleep a whole lot, I'll put it that way.
More partying than sleeping?
More partying than sleeping, yeah.
But you probably are a small percentage of the homeless in Berkeley here, right?
No, we're a pretty big percentage are actually drug and alcohol free, but... sorry, I had to move real quick. A pretty big percentage are drug and alcohol free. It's just that's the stigma that's placed on the homeless, unfortunately.
Right, but of the people who are drug and alcohol free, not most of the people here are here. In other words, there's a much...
No, a lot of them hide because they're, you know what I mean? One, you get scared of, especially about personal belongings and stuff, but then they're scared too because they know the cops have raided us and they have been violent, so they're fearful of getting hurt by the police or getting arrested.
Your estimates of the homeless population is... of Berkeley?
Probably 1,100.
And so you're like 1% or something?
Yeah, I mean, it could be higher, but I don't really know.
2 or 3%.
Yes, yeah.
David, sorry. So where are most of the folks?
They're hiding in doorsteps, they're hiding in alleyways, they're hiding. You know, we've been pushed into hiding. We shouldn't be, we're human beings.
And is there any organizing efforts going out with those folks? Like there's a so-called Union of the Homeless now in Salinas, which was more of a label than I think an organization, but they were camped outside City Hall for 6 months every night. Although they didn't, were not an occupation. They weren't a 24-hour occupation.
Yeah, yeah.
Because in Salinas there was a special law created as a compromise with social service providers that allowed people to camp at night, which they then eliminated.
Of course, yeah.
About a month ago. And so they swept away that encampment. But for 6 months they were there,
And they formed a thing called the Salinas Union of the Homeless, or maybe it was the Monterey County Union of the Homeless. Anything like that happening here?
Not that I'm aware of. I know people do wander up and find us, you know what I mean? We're not exactly hiding.
You have no union cards.
We have no union cards. We got no union dues, although if somebody wants to pay, come by and pay us some union dues, I'm down.
I do have an offer of a Tootsie Roll Pop.
I do like lollipops.
And it's a red lollipop. Keep that in mind.
It's cherry flavored. It's even better.
It is the best.
Yeah.
And we have been talking with...
Straps.
Thank you, Straps.
You're very welcome.
All right. I'll give you my card, let you know when this thing comes on free radio. It's archived, so...
Yeah.
You can always play it later if you want, although you know it is.
And that was Berkeley about a week and a half ago. And this is the stream of free radio. Perhaps you're listening to the archive since we began with a troubled broadcast, and now we're working through it, looks like, thanks to the faithful work of... one of our long-term broadcasters, are more techie savvy than I am, for damn sure. We've got this thing back on the air. Salute to R. Duck. Thank you, R. Duck. He will, by the way, be doing a live podcast of Uncle Dennis's show, which is normally follows mine, called The Cream, From the Cream to the Dregs. It happens from 8 to 11. But Dennis is battling with some serious illness, and Al is taking over, I should say, R. Duck is taking over his situation. And so you might want to listen in from 8 to 11 to hear a live podcast, not from this studio, which is it's not a freezing place, but it is kind of a cold night out here, and some of us have to kind of come in from adjoining communities to Santa Cruz. Some people have been priced out of the housing in Santa Cruz and don't live there anymore, and they're on the outskirts, but they haven't given up on Santa Cruz, and they regard themselves, I suspect, as part of the community here. So I have set aside some clippings that I wanted to make a quick note on. Here's one from the Chronicle of yesterday, actually, by Bob Agelko, who actually is a interesting legal writer. I don't know much about his background or history, but he writes regularly in the second section of the San Francisco Chronicle, if you ever read about it. I put too much stock in establishment media. It's kind of like an addiction, Tootsie Roll Pops or chocolate or something like that, for those of us who still maintain our childhood addictions. But his article here is Suit Against Cop in Shooting Reinstated. Appeals court says case can proceed after video contradicts statement. And this is about a federal appeals court reinstating a wrongful death suit Tuesday against a North Coast, California police officer who said he shot a suspect who was swinging a club at another officer. Unfortunately, the statement, the court said, was contradicted by both a video and the dead man's autopsy. Jacob Newsmaker, 26, was killed in a March 2012 confrontation with police in Fortuna. That's 4 years ago. Humboldt County. Officer Maxwell Suth said Newsmaker, who had come to the police station at midnight asking for help because people were chasing him, was seen around 6 a.m. banging on the doors and windows of a home. Sounds a little like Sean Arlt here in Santa Cruz, who was shot dead by our police department about a month ago. But that's just my interjection. South, who chased him on foot, that's Officer South, or Sooth, actually, S-O-E-T-H, and caught him, said he had stunned Newsmaker. Newsmaker is the name of the victim here, or the suspect, as the police might say, several times with a stun gun and clubbed him with his baton when he resisted. A second officer, Sergeant Charles Elsbrecht, soon arrived and tried to subdue Newsmaker. Actually, I'm sorry, it's Newmaker, not Newsmaker. The suspect grabbed Suth's baton and swung it at Ellsbrick's head, Suth said. Suth said he shot Newsmaker after he refused to drop the baton and then shot him again after he first fell, then tried to get up and take another swing. However, the lawsuit by Newmaker's parents against Suth, Ellsbrick, and the city of Fortuna, well, it was dismissed by U.S. District Judge Phyllis Hamilton of Oakland, who said Suth, the officer, had reasonably feared that his fellow officer was in danger. But on Tuesday, I guess that was the day before yesterday, The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco said the officer's statement conflicted with other evidence. A jury should decide whether the shooting was justified, the court said. An autopsy showed that Newmaker was shot twice in the back. Judge William Fletcher said in the 3-0 ruling, in other words, all three judges said, send it for a trial, don't just drop it. And again, we're not talking about trying these officers for murder, which, of course, they probably should be tried for. I don't want to sound prejudiced, but based upon what I'm reading, that's my preliminary notion. Instead, they're just being sued for money, which, of course, no doubt the officers, associations, and the city will settle for or help with or continue to do whatever they've been doing, regardless of whether the officers are found liable for the damages. Anyway, Judge Fletcher, the guy who said, you got to go take this case to trial, you can't just drop it, that's at least for financial damages. He said the angle of the bullets was inconsistent with Suth's statements that Newmaker had been standing and swinging the baton when he was first shot and then trying to rise when he was shot again. A video from Ellsbrecht's dashboard showed nothing clearly visible in Newmaker's hands when he fell after the first shot, Fletcher said. He said the officers' statements also conflicted with one another in several details and that both officers had changed their narratives after, quote, receiving suggestions from a DA's investigator who interviewed them a day after the shooting. A reasonable jury could conclude that Suth and Ellsbrecht were wrong when they claimed that Newmaker grabbed the baton, perhaps that they were lying, oh, but the judge doesn't want to say that, or that Newmaker was swinging the baton when Suth shot him for a second time, Fletcher said. Wrong about that as well. He said that such a suit should not be dismissed without a trial when the outcome rests on the officer's credibility that is genuinely in doubt. Now, the first question that comes to my mind is why did the first judge, the local federal judge, dismiss this case at all, given this, what appears to be really contradictory evidence? In fact, it may be evidence that would indicate that the DA is covering up the case, a criminal case, against what should be laid against these two officers. Heavens to Betsy. What an unusual situation. Eric Valenzuela, a lawyer for Newmaker's family, said they were happy about the ruling. Newmaker had mental health and drug problems, Valenzuela said, but now it's only burial problems, thanks to these two fine officers. That's my addition. But he also had a family who cared about him and was greatly affected when he was killed. Nancy Delaney, a lawyer for the officers and the city, said they may ask the full appeals court for a rehearing. That's your money defending what may be killer cops and then a cover-up district attorney, as well as a co-opted judge, the earlier judge who ruled against this case, that it shouldn't be, that there was no basis for any kind of a trial. That would be, who is the judge? Let me see if I can find it. Still looking. Judge Phyllis Hamilton of Oakland. Judge Hamilton, back to law school, or possibly, I don't know what else to tell you. Anyway, that's a story in the San Francisco Chronicle. San Francisco court reinstates suit against officer Wednesday, November 23rd, in Section 2. And then we have another story. Family files suit against officer who shot dog. San Diego by Lindsay Winky. This is from the San Diego Union Tribune, and it's, again, from yesterday's paper. This one from yesterday's, I think it's the Mercury News. The family of a dog that was shot by a San Diego police filed a lawsuit Tuesday, claiming the killing was unwarranted and that officers callously allowed the pet to bleed to death in the aftermath. Sort of what they do with people in different places. Grizzly, a 7-year-old mixed breed, was shot at least three times by San Diego police officer Robert Meiselman on February 22nd. The officer was investigating reports of a stolen truck and had gone into the fenced-in yard of a home on Thorn Street near 42nd Street in search of witnesses. According to the complaint, the officer was told by the neighbor who reported the stolen truck that a family dog lived on the property. There were also several beware of dog signs posted on the fence that surrounded the home. Meiselman entered the property and was banging on the door when Grizzly emerged. That's the 7-year-old mixed-breed dog. Police said that the dog lunged at the officer, who feared for his life, and shot the animal about 12:45 a.m. The dog's owners, Alfredo and Socorro Fuentes, said they were startled awake by the officer's pounding. Alfredo Fuentes was just about to open the door when he heard the gunshots. He walked outside and spotted a bloody trail that led him to his dying dog. The family said that Alfredo Fuentes repeatedly asked the officer to help him with his bloodied pet, but he was ignored. At one point, an officer gave Fuentes the address of a pet hospital 7 miles away. Police said they called the County Department of Animal Services after the shooting, but that a dispatcher said the dog was the owner's responsibility as long as he was alive. Ah, but they will take care of the corpse. How thoughtful. It is unclear if the dispatcher knew the dog had been wounded during an officer-involved shooting. The Fuentes family subsequently repeated pleas for the police officers on the scene to get medical help for their beloved dog, and they were ignored, the complaint read. Grizzly ultimately bled to death over a period of 2 hours. One of the lawyers representing the family, attorney Jill Reither, said the shooting was one of the most disturbing cases she'd seen. The Fuentes family is suing Meiselman, the San Diego Police Department, and the City of San Diego for an amount in excess of $75,000, which, of course, the taxpayers will be paying if the suit succeeds. But note, Luke Smith was shot to death because he was defending himself against a police dog. High on LSD, they say, and I don't dispute that, surrounded by 11 police officers, and this happened about a week ago. But the police dog was so important to the police that they don't mind shooting someone to protect a police dog. That's not the official story, of course, by Sheriff Hart, our county sheriff. But it does seem to be likely what happened. Not for sure. I don't know for sure. But he had a 4-inch pocket knife, according to accounts in the Sentinel that have been repeatedly. So I presume I have read the sheriff's report, too. That was a press release. And I'm not quite sure if that was the dimensions of the knife mentioned, but it hasn't been disputed by the sheriff's department. But notice, the life of a dog is of high value, more important than a human life, when it's a police dog. So it's not just police officers. Oh, yes, police dogs are officers as well, of course, you see. They are valued more highly than ordinary human beings and ordinary human dogs. And we're not talking about San Diego. We're talking about Santa Cruz, folks. We're talking about Santa Cruz County. That's the wonderful Sheriff Hart Department that is so much into the 21st century policing and is getting so much praise from the ACLU, Vice Chair Steve Plaich, and others in that group. You can hear, perhaps, the skepticism, the scorn, and the disdain in my voice. If not, it's there, believe me. Here's another one, this one from out of state. Details still hazy in North Carolina shooting, again from yesterday's Mercury News. So we're talking about very, very recent police killings, one might even say police murders, all over the country, which, you know, it's interesting that they're getting some publicity. I'm wondering about those that aren't getting publicity, but some are now getting publicity. And not in alternative press media, but in the mainstream media, so to speak, as much of a mainstream media that we have here. But before I read that, let's listen to who's calling in. This is probably Raylan Butcher from Marysville to give us a report. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert.
Hello?
Hi there. Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Hello?
Hello? Robert.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
You're fading in and out there, Raylan.
Okay.
Yeah, you're. It's pretty.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. So I know we talked earlier, and you're looking forward, or I should say dreading, the December 7th demolition of the jungle, the last encampment in Marysville, California.
Yeah. Actually, I do believe that's the date that they're going to come in and start killing people of their services that they have, and then give them a lot of time to vacate the premises, the property.
And what kind of services? This has actually happened before, right, to other encampments.
Yes, it's happened to like three different encampments in town. Yeah, it's on the outskirts of town, on the river bottom.
And but no services as far as what they need, as far as gas, as far as maybe somebody has a registration paid for their cars.
Let me ask you, and we're talking, of course, to Brian and to Butcher, if I'm not mistaken, or to Raylan, I should say. Sorry, Raylan. What are these encampments consist of? Are they mostly tents? Are they mostly vehicles? What are they?
Pardon me?
Are the encampments mostly, what kind of structures are they? Vehicles, tents, little wooden shacks, three-story houses? What are these encampments?
Actually, variety. Most of them, per se, have got pretty good places. They've got a lot of pallets. There's a lot of tents and tarps.
And so the encampment that you were a part of, how big was it, and what did it mostly consist of?
As far as the area?
As far as the structures, and as well as the area.
Well, the structures are not meaning to go as far as they can just pick up and go. They're just basically the tents, the tarps, the trailers, the mobile homes. The places that they've just built out of wood, nothing permanent like structure or anything such as.
And how long has the average person who comes to such a, who came to your prior encampment, and what was the name of your prior encampment, by the way?
The prior encampment, the one that we just were at?
The one that you were forced out of, yes.
Yeah, Hollywood.
So how many, not just how many people, but how many people were there, but how long was the average person there in Hollywood?
Oh, man, on the average.
Myself, I was there 13 years.
I'd say the average of 4 years.
Yeah.
4 years,
yeah.
And so during this time, did police kind of direct people to this encampment when they found them and said, we don't want you in town,
yeah.
Go to the encampment?
Yeah,
that sort
yeah
of
they did.
Yes, they did quite a few times.
Yes. Yeah.
And was yours a sort of what was I just listened to somebody else from Berkeley talking about their encampment there. They're having a protest encampment outside City Hall, have for quite a while. But was your encampment what they call an intentional community? In other words, did you sort of select or could anyone come there? Or was it drug and alcohol free?
Yeah.
Or was it a mixture?
Yeah, what would happen is like a police officer would find somebody in a place like down by the boat dock or where a lot of people, you know, go with their kids or whatever, and they would like tell them you can't camp here because it'd be like too close to the bridge or something, and then they would send them over to my and Brian's camp, and then we would find them a camp spot. So, yeah, quite a few times, and quite a few times in the last couple of years, the Marysville Police Department or the Eva
City
County
Council,
Sheriff,
the
City Council.
District Supervisor.
Yeah, they would send them to us, and then we would find them a camp.
Now, did you do this without any, you know, like, requirements? In other words, was everybody who came given an opportunity to camp, or did you have some kind of, you know, restrictive intake process? What was that like?
Yeah, it was. It was a thing to where we had to stay within the realms, no lying, cheating, or stealing, and lock up your dogs, keep your dogs up, keep the garbage, the shopping cart out,
uh-huh.
And make the etiquette look halfway, I mean, presentable, no human waste there. Dispose of your waste, keep it to a good camp etiquette. Is that what we had?
Yeah, actually, a couple of times.
How did you dispose of waste? Was there a porta potty? Was there access to bathrooms nearby? How did you deal with that? Hello?
Hello? Yeah, we're here.
So how did you
break it up a little bit?
Yeah, how did you dispose of waste? How did you dispose of shit and piss?
We would take some of it sewer plant. We would have it in 5 gallon buckets and take it to the sewer plant.
And then, like me, I made my own bathroom. I made it 6 feet deep. I made it at least with lime. I put lime in there to dispose of it as far as naturally. I had these
cadaver bugs that we were imported that took up, and it, they ate everything that went into it, so kind of went back into the ecosystem, is what I did.
And how many people were a part of this Hollywood camp, Brian?
Approximately 100 people. 107 any given time. It could probably be up to 140 with their friends there. But as far as that, 107, I'd say permanently.
And were there requirements as far as drug use, or was it simply kind of, if you use drugs, do so discreetly and privately?
Yes, yes, they did. But a lot of them were coming, like, some of them were coming out of prison or out of a rehab, nowhere to go. And the services, they'd go and, you know, talk to people, and they'd got nothing. They'd get denied, so they would end up on the river.
We did have four or five people with about 30-plus years of parole kick their parole down there, and word has it that they was going to run the program.
And they worked our program.
They worked the program down there, and they got on parole. We did better than most people in town on the
Like I would tell them, I said, look, if you're on parole or probation, you don't want to be here because I'm not the one. But if you want me to help you with your parole, I will, because I know a lot of the parole agents.
So is there a large prison nearby?
The address down there, yeah.
Is there a large prison nearby?
Okay, do you, the address at Hollywood.
Is there a large prison nearby?
No, the closest one, I do believe is a DVI, Tracy, I think. That's the closest prison to here.
So you had about 100 people. What was the gender mix?
A gender mix.
In other words, how many men, how many women?
Right now, as it looks, there's probably, I would say, there's out of 20 people, you're going to talk about 15 or 14 men to about 6 or 7 women, and about 0 kids, maybe 1 or 2.
We got
1 or 2.
At the jungle, we got 1, 2,
but just as
4.
Far as men and women.
We have 6 children at the jungle.
But as far as men and women, it's about that. Out of 20 people, it would be...
So this is now, after Hollywood was dispersed, there were... more than 100 people, but now there are only 20 or 30 of you left?
No, there's nobody at Hollywood, but all the people scattered around town and in this park called the Jungle and went to 14-4 and is in the waiting list, and they're just hanging out in the street
and in the parking lot.
Is there a community that comes together? I mean, do folks kind of know each other, or is it all pretty anonymous?
Well, it was like this, where... all the encampments, we were all in separate places because some of them don't get along too well, you know, and they don't play well together. So they were all in different encampments. Well, now they have put us all in the same encampment. And as of the 7th, they're going to come down and they're going to do the same thing that they did at the Horseshoe, the Hollywood, and Auger and Avondale. And all them people are just like scattered. I mean, it's bad,
but they did do something that's really terrible. They ran over 60 elderberries. They wiped out my place, and I was covered with elderberries. Now, over there where we're talking, they're going to go on the 7th. There is a
Before we go into that, let me ask you, Brian, you talked in the past. We had interviews a couple weeks ago before the crackdown on, you know, the Hollywood encampment. Did you were talking about making a stand there? Did many folks decide to do that, or did folks pretty much just sort of pack up and move?
They pretty much just packed up and scattered. And they didn't really join us in the move, in the stand. We were there, but nobody else as far as that. Yeah, no, nobody, Robert, actually.
So how long did you and did the two of you decide to stand? Did you stay very long, or did you just sort of realize you felt it was a futile thing to have the two of you there and just took off? How much of a stand did you make?
We did our signs, and we stood out, and we demonstrated about our amendment rights, about our civil rights, right uptown at Washington Square. That's a flagpole.
So you demonstrated, but how soon did you leave the camp after the bulldozers arrived or they told you to leave?
Okay, actually, when they came 24 hours we had, and if we didn't leave, we were going to get arrested.
Yeah, code enforcement came in and told us we had 24 hours to get out. and that's
and we told them that we haven't been served correctly, and they said you were served back in March, which that's not true. No, they have all the paperwork, but there's no paperwork. We've never been served, only been verbally told, and 24 hours they posted a subservient, which is notice to for abatement, which still gives me a process, which they just ran that door over that sign was on. That's we didn't do anything after that.
So
24 hours is what we got.
So there isn't a willingness for really, I'm not saying there should be even, but there isn't a willingness or an inclination to make a stand in the sense of saying, no, you know, you want us to leave, you got to arrest us. Nobody wants to do that. That's sort of beyond the bounds of what folks are considering at the moment.
Yes, that's true.
And so, I mean, I understand that. So you are now facing a December 7th eviction of a much larger group of people, right? How many people are being menaced on December 7th? Sorry.
I'd have to say way over 200 people now, close to 300 at least, because that's covering all the people that moved from the Horseshoe Pit, Hollywood,
Avondale.
And
across the river.
Across the river from us, which is called the Shad Pad.
Right.
And then the people that were just along the banks of the Yuba and the Feather River, all the way to Shanghai Bend, which that covers quite a large area, which is roughly over 400 homeless people along those two rivers. And now they've all, like, been told and moved to the jungle. And now they're coming in the 7th and going to do the same exact thing that they just did.
And now the 14th Ford has got a process of 40 and 100 waiting. And most of those, I'd say half of those are couch surfers that was in town.
Yeah, and now they've got even people that were from the other encampments that have, like, a couple of their trailers out in the parking lot. And they're telling them they got to go. Well, where are we going to go? Where are they going to go? They have no place.
They made a sleep zone right on the other side of the levee, approximately 200 yards, that was made by the city and designated for us to sleep Monday and then go over 50 feet and then pick up their camp.
You can only stay there
every other day, tonight. Right. You can't take anything else, but nothing but tents, but they're not.
Yeah, no motorhomes, no trailers,
no nothing. There's gravel there. There's no bathroom or garbage. That's the only alternative that these people are going to have.
So how many people have more than tents or had more than tents when they were forced to move? What number of people were dispossessed of their non-tent shelter, if you understand what I mean? You follow me?
How many people were dispossessed of everything that they had?
At
the chemist. Everybody.
Everybody
lost everything.
Yeah, they lost a lot.
But you told me that people could take their tents.
The bulldozer.
You told me that people could take their tents, but they weren't allowed to take other things. Is that correct?
Started like kindergarten, and she had all of his clothes.
So in other words, you told me that people could take their tents, but they couldn't take other things? Is that what you're saying?
No, they wouldn't let them because if they took any time after the 24 hours, they were going to arrest them, and then they said they would let them out after they got through running over their shit. It's exact hours.
So did people mostly, they took their tents before the 24-hour deadline?
No, after the 24 hours, they would come in, and they would tell them, look.
Yeah.
I'm asking you, though, that before the 24-hour deadline, did people vacate voluntarily and then take their tents with them?
Came in, and they just tore it up.
Did they take their tents with them before the 24-hour deadline was up?
Some people did, but a couple people didn't even know nothing about it because they were way off in the bushes. And they woke up to the sound, and they're going, wow, what's going on? And a couple people didn't even jump back in the bushes because they're, like, seeing these big cats coming at them, you know, and pushing dirt and stuff. It was terrible.
And me, personally.
Well, I know you two were there with video cameras because I watched some of the video. I guess I wanted to ask you, though, how many people had structures that they couldn't take with them because they were more solid? Are there wooden structures or they were vehicles that couldn't move? How many people would you say lost those structures?
Trailers, mobile homes, tents.
Yeah. How many people would you say that involved?
It took 14 days to do it.
Yeah.
How many people would you say were involved? How many people would you say were involved?
I'd say at least 60 or 70 camps, and each one was a person plus anywhere
and
for that.
Family.
And family.
Again, I'm not talking about tents so much because although I understand people could have, you know, had their tents destroyed if they didn't move, but those who couldn't move their stuff because they were too permanent, because they were just unable to do it, or they were told they wouldn't be allowed to do it, how many people did that affect? Do you understand what I mean?
Didn't help them, so they lost their trailers.
Yeah, how many would you say lost their trailers or whatever else they had?
Man, I really can't count. I really don't know a whole lot.
That's the kind of issue that's important to be able to document, for example, in this upcoming Hollywood or jungle destruction that is about to happen on December 7th. And, of course, it's hard to do in the middle of the chaos and confusion. You're trying to help people find another place. You know, I understand it's not easy. But if you're trying to, you know, cook up material for a potential lawsuit and an injunction against this practice, you want to get, you know, as I kind of mentioned to you before, tag the property in advance, and then B, have a record of the and pictures of the police or the deputies or whoever destroying it or taking it away or refusing to allow you to take it away.
Yeah, that's what we have did on it, advisory. Yeah. That's what we did, and we were getting ready to do it now over there when they do come. I'm going to try to be a little bit better prepared this time. I'm going to try to get some newscast down there to get some publicity the night before. That's what I'm going to try to do.
Yeah, I think that I think also if you get some volunteers and train them, some homeless folks maybe who, you know, or some sympathetic housed folks nearby who are willing to stand by with cameras and also essentially notebooks to notice and document which property is being taken, who owned it, and where it's going and how it, you know, gets trashed when it's valuable property to those folks. Then you have some documentation that might interest lawyers because the lawyers, as you know, want to make money. And if they think they can win a lawsuit, then they can get paid.
You know, adding to that, you know what's really, I just got some demographics on the property lines, and they're changing the property lines at will across private property areas where they have already did. They're just going on the private property and taking everything off of private property, so there's nothing safe.
Now, do you have, Brian, a lot of people, Brian, who own private property who are letting you stay there?
Yes. Yeah.
And are they protesting the city or the county or whatever jurisdiction is doing this?
Yes, they're protesting the action. Yes, they are.
Now is this an area where a lot of people own guns, by the way?
No.
I don't mean necessarily how unhoused people or homeless folks, but people who are in houses. Is this a conservative area where some people own weapons to protect themselves or to go hunting or whatever?
Not really.
In town, maybe, but not.
No, not really. Around there's apartment complexes, family life around there.
A lot of military. Yeah.
So military people may have their weapons. So.
Yeah, they're
right over the levee from where the encampment is.
Yeah, it's the main military apartment.
Have you got any friends in the military who would consider coming out and saying something like, consider coming out and saying something like, this is private property, you have no right to be here, please leave, to authorities that come out?
Well, you know what, we would have people to spoke for that, as far as we could have the paperwork to show them. And it's not going to matter.
I don't think so. I think what's happened is the city mayor here, Rick Samoya, he has really turned the evil eye on the homeless and made us look like pure dirt. And he won't even shake your hand. And at the meetings, I notice he's just like wants to pass on by, not even give us our time to say anything at the podium or nothing. He's like really
kind of like you guys going down there.
Yeah, he's been really rude lately, and he just got reelected.
Sorry to hear it. So we've been talking with Raylan Butcher and Brian. I'm sorry, I forgot your last name. Tell me again.
Brown. Sorry. Brian Brown. There's no Browns around.
All right. Right on. So I'm gonna roll now because actually I got limited time. But if you want to call in on Sunday with an update, we can do that then.
Can
pick up the conversation.
Okay. Yeah, we can do that, Robert. We're looking forward to maybe the prelude of the February 16th and 17th.
homeless meetings with you guys to show up there.
That's
so,
in February 17th
we'll
talking about.
We'll keep in contact for sure.
Well, thank you very much, and good luck
You're
to you guys.
You're very welcome.
And thank you, Robert, and happy Thanksgiving to all.
And for those who are interested, Raylan Butcher can be found online, as can you, Brian Brown, with your videos about what's been happening. If you look under what, Marysville Raylan Butcher?
Raylan Butcher YouTube on YouTube.
And we will have some new ones coming out too, Robert. We're just waiting our turn here.
And I also have a blog too. It's Raylan Butcher. Just Google my name and it'll come up.
Sounds good. Thank you. Bye-bye. And phone lines are now open, 427-3772, 427-3772. And I'll return now to a few other interviews, these from the more local area here, and perhaps your phone calls, who knows. Let's see what we got.
A man who is sunning himself on a windy day on the curbside while smoking a remains of a ciggy, and who has a band on his left wrist indicating some sort of hospital thingy. You got bands all over your wrist, man.
Yeah. These are ground scores.
Okay. But you yourself have pneumonia and...
I got cancer and pneumonia, and my sisters have taking all my money. Hell, they killed my mother and my grandmother this way. It's called greed, and it's called voodoo dolls.
But you are writing a book.
And they've already done it all backwards. It's called Voodoo Doll Backwards, I guess.
What about that book?
My book I've been writing for 3 years and 2 months. My name is Stan Wells, and I need help. I need someone, some good attorney or something to help me so I can see my daughter after 24 years.
And your book is about what subject, Stan?
About my sisters killing my family. They burned me up in a fire. They killed me. They must have hired dentists to burn my warehouse down in 2001. August 10th, 5 days before my birthday, it was all set up. I know it was.
How is Santa Cruz treating you? Or should I ask?
I'm not allowed to sit on sidewalks. I already paid $160 last month.
But it is legal for you to sit on this curbside right here, as far as I know. But just don't try it on Pacific Avenue, mister.
No.
Actually, you can sit on the curb, but you can't sit more safely away from the toxic fumes by the side of a building, even if you're not blocking anything. So it's weird. Any final thoughts, Stan?
I just need help with my book. Do you know any good lawyers?
None will help us. I mean, I'm looking for somebody myself. How can people reach you if they want to? If you want to say it.
I'm at 115 Coral Street. My name is Stan Wells. The address is 115 Coral Street, 95060.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Send me a letter or send me the truth or send me something that's real. I'm tired of this phony bullshit crap.
Thank you, Stan.
Blown away.
So I'm for her to serve pine for a computer now on an empty weed pipe. No.
And we're here at the Food Not Bombs meal where it's serving out of the rain under the eaves of the post office.
Explain to you.
Sure. Well, yeah, as soon as I get her attention, I will.
The officer came there and saw an empty weed pipe, or even if I was full. Came to her, asked her who the weed pipe belonged to. She said it's mine. She put it in her purse.
And what we're listening to, I kind of intervened in a heated recounting of the case of Cooper. You've heard, those of you who listen to the show regularly or previously, she was a woman who was arrested and, by her account, brutalized a year ago on Halloween by police, essentially for a weed pipe. And she wasn't charged with any crime other than resisting arrest, I believe, and obstructing an officer. I've got a, I think that's my recollection of this. She went to trial a year later after going through a number of public defenders, and they kept urging her to take a plea. She refused, repeatedly saying that she wanted the officers involved exposed and disciplined and retrained and held accountable for the brutality that they engaged in. I'm probably catching most of that right. And instead, she was tried by a public defender who said it didn't represent her. She wasn't allowed to represent herself in a meaningful way. She went through five different judicial officers, a commissioner, and four judges. And she was eventually found guilty and then didn't attend the sentencing hearing because she felt so outraged at the court process. So this is some of the discussion around that I caught. Feelings were pretty high. This was in the rain or in wet weather last Saturday at Food Not Bombs on the 19th. And it was on the steps of the main post office where Food Not Bombs occasionally serves when it's raining. It's Food Not Bombs has been harassed by postal officials in the past for being there, but they've ignored it, and the police have not, even though they've come and sort of stalked around a bit, haven't attempted to drive Food Not Bombs away, and the postal officials haven't called in the National Guard or the FBI or the NSA or whatever, the Homeland Security, whatever kinds of federal agencies they might have access to, postal militia, I don't know. So the Food Not Bombs continues to serve there, but generally they serve on the corner when the weather is good. But with the raining weather, and there's going to be rain day after tomorrow on Saturday, it's likely that they'll be back at the post office and probably without any incident from the authorities. But that's kind of the background of this recording because it's you're going to hear perhaps more tumult than clarity. But let's see what we got.
Okay, so be it.
I know.
Yeah, instead, grabs a purse, pulls it out, said that it's obstructing justice, told her to sit down. She didn't sit down. So now you're resisting arrest, so you slammed it to the ground, bashed her head.
This was Officer...
My public defender was so frazzled.
Let her tell you.
Anyway.
D. Albert. Officer D. Albert.
I cannot see nothing.
Right, I'm just, we're waiting until she's finished talking to Abby. So. Anything happened in the last week or so of any note, do you think?
No. Just my friend got ran over, that's all.
I think it was in the paper, yeah?
Yeah.
And his name was?
Hmm?
His name?
Hamilton. His last name is Hamilton.
You want to say something about him?
No. It's the wrong date. They had the pig under the wrong person's name. Same name.
So I've also heard that Cooper, who we're talking about, who was jailed a year ago at Halloween for a crime of allegedly resisting arrest, obstructing an officer on this bogus marijuana pipe stuff. She finally went to trial a year later, although all the time trying to raise the issue of police abuse, the fact that she had been assaulted by the police officer involved. And she went through, according to the account I heard previously, a couple weeks ago, five separate judges. And she's now explaining it to Abby. Abby Samuels of Food Not Bombs.
Against that 280-pound officer.
So it's a setup from God, because there's 20 witnesses.
120?
One of the witnesses...
But it looks like, according to her partner, she did not go to the sentencing hearing. And
I didn't go back. They tried everything on the wrong days.
Fuck the court system.
Yeah, they covered up.
They even went and tampered with the jury, because the judge stepped out, went to the jury room, boom, found a verdict guilty the first day. The next day, for the next verdict, was guilty, and there was another judge on the bench.
And passions are definitely running high in this case.
This is a total setup, though.
All tax money.
Yeah.
And on the other side of the entrance, the post office here under the eaves. We have about 10 folks seated, some meeting, some sitting. Any three reports, guys?
Just
waiting for my guitar to get back from the police department because they decided that they needed to play it or something.
Implement of a crime.
They arrested me for no reason on Halloween at Taco Bell, and I have no blankets that you know, they took all my stuff for no reason.
And have you gone to the police station on Tuesdays and Thursdays?
I tried to go on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and they said, we're going to hold your guitar and your blanket for evidence. I go, for what? You never even read me my rights. You put me in jail for no reason.
What are they accusing you of?
They don't have anything.
Do they say what the charge is?
They're going to use it for evidence of no crime.
Did you get a ticket?
No, but I got thrown in jail and I lost my guitar.
Did you have to make a court date to get out?
They made a court date, and I had to just wait for it to get... Luckily, they let me out in 2 hours, but there was no reason for it. I mean, what are they doing with my guitar? Why do they want my guitar?
Maybe they like to play in the station.
That's what I was saying. Why did they just ask to borrow it or something? I could have taught them something.
You don't know what they're charging you with in this court date.
I don't know. I have no idea. I'm ready to get an attorney, though, because it sounds like they're trying to frame me.
When is your court date?
In December.
We're talking with?
Jeff Patterson.
Thanks, Jeff. Anything else happen on the street you want to pass on?
I got stoned today.
How's that?
Luckily, it was good.
You seem pretty coherent for a stoned guy.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jeff. So we're talking with
Jason.
And Jason, you asked me what's the difference now that Proposition 64 passed and recreational marijuana supposedly is more legal than before.
You're not allowed to do.
Well, you're allowed to possess six joints or 1 ounce of marijuana for recreational purposes. Now that's a good question. You can't smoke in public.
Okay.
and there's a question of how it can be carried around in public. I don't know the exact law here. I've heard different things, so I don't want to mislead you. Understandably, properly so.
Yeah.
In January, it'll be legal. In theory, it's legal for some people to sell it. It's not legal for you to sell it. It's not legal for you to trade it. It's not legal for you to give it away.
Is it legal to grow it at home?
It is legal to grow it at home, up to six plants, I think it is.
Wow, that's great, I suppose.
I think.
And let me interject here, because I actually had a fuller report of the Santa Cruz City Council meeting, which I guess I'm really going to give on Sunday. I will hope to do a longer show then, which I usually do from 9:30 to 1 or 2, depending on my stamina and the equipment stamina. But the city and the county, the city council and the board of supervisors, the two bodies that govern these two that lord it over all of us, have essentially, I don't know what the specific county regulation is, but I think they passed a ban on temporary ban on dispensaries for recreational marijuana in the county. I'm not sure about that, but I do know that there was an issue up for discussion or vote in the city on Tuesday at the Santa Cruz City Council, and I spoke against it, and it had an unusual outcome. It was postponed. I was very surprised, and I'm actually going to talk more about that on Sunday. The plan was to make it illegal to have any outdoor grows at all in the city for recreational marijuana, though for medical marijuana, I think you can still grow medical marijuana, or could. And you still can, and right now you can still, I believe you can still grow recreational marijuana, at least up to six plants. I believe that's what it is. Again, I'm sorry to be so foggy on this. It's an important issue. At least it's one I keep bringing up. So perhaps I will educate myself, making notes even to myself as we speak. Let's see. Anyway, let's continue hearing a little more from a Food Not Bombs meal last Saturday. You know, and if you want more information, just go online. You have access to a computer?
I do.
Look up Proposition 64 and see 64. What the current law is. That's where it was.
I'm curious. Yeah. I'm very curious.
And when you find out, you can tell me.
All right, I'll do that. Thank you.
Anything happening on the street you want to pass on?
A lot of less street people, I'd say.
Less street people.
There is, this year.
I've seen a lot of people here. Maybe these folks are travelers. I mean, and it's rain. People are trying to get out of the rain under the eaves of the post office here. You see a Food Not Bombs stable out there under the trees.
And it's interesting because the what I hear from folks who aren't street folks is that there's more street folks on the street, although less. I don't want to say less in the downtown area. My perception is there's far less the street community in the downtown area, and only sort of newcomers or are hardcore folks who are who have no options or who don't seem entirely conscious or cognizant, or some would call them wingnuts, people who are very loud and vocal about how they're feeling at the moment, whatever they happen to feel and whoever happens to be around, who are, you know, this is probably the basis for apparently intensifying the so-called mental health funding by a factor of six and cutting instead senior services, immigrant support, and other things, essentially it seems to me to glamorize the downtown area. It doesn't have a hell of a lot to do with, maybe I'm being cynical here, taking care of real problems that folks have and dealing with real life crises. Although I got to tell you, I don't have a clear reading on how effective or ineffective local services are, though I have heard a lot of positive things and some negative things about MHCAN, Mental Health Clients Action Network, run by Sarah Leonard, with a board of directors headed by none other than that man who's in every board of directors you can name, Steve Plaich, failed city council candidate, and also the guy who's behind the Homeless Legal Assistance Project, although I'm not sure how much legal assistance has been provided lately. He does write a lot of articles, and he does keep up the Freedom Sleepers, I don't know if it's a website or a Facebook page. He's often down there taking photos. He and I and are two people who both were regular Freedom Sleepers for a while at the beginning of the Freedom Sleepouts a year ago, but then now we're just occasional visitors. I write an article about the Tuesday opponents of the sleeping ban who sleep every Tuesday in front of City Hall. He comes and does pictures of them and posts them on Facebook. And Alex DeRosi does a more thorough job than either of us, it seems, in actually documenting what goes on. He's down there at the wee hours of the morning taking photos, and every three or four Freedom Sleepouts, he's got a story about what went down. I'm hoping that one will be coming out again soon on the Santa Cruz Indie Media website. That's indiebay.org/Santa Cruz. You just browse for Santa Cruz Indie Media, and you'll find it. Let's hear some more from under the eaves of the post office in the rain, or in wet weather anyway, a week ago.
It just seems like there isn't that many people, right?
Well, that's true, actually. It's Saturday. I don't see what time it is. It's 5 o'clock, so maybe, have you been here long?
An hour.
It's been about the same number here, or there was a bigger number?
It's been minimal. I'd say there's maybe a few more people, but not many.
And we've been talking with?
Jason.
Thanks, Jason. Should be on free radio. So I'm talking with?
Zach Martin.
And Zach, you're a newcomer, old-timer?
Newcomer.
How new are you?
Like 3 days, maybe.
And what do you think?
I'm pretty happy with the place, actually.
No hassles from police, rangers, security?
No, not at all.
You've been sleeping comfortably in the frosty weather?
I have, actually. I'm a traveler. I travel with a vehicle and a trailer.
No hassles for sleeping in your vehicle?
No. I found a cozy spot.
So, mad criminal that you are, you're able to sleep at night still?
Yeah, I'm a pretty bad guy for that one.
Criminal sleeper. And are you involved with this man?
Yes, I'm a traveler with this man.
And what's your name, sir?
My name is Heather.
And any reports about Santa Cruz from you?
Well, I've been coming here for about 3 years, two or three times a year, and I always love it. But the energy is really positive and beautiful right now. I'm loving it.
Well, this is unusual. Thank you both. Anything either of you want to add?
No, thanks. Skate more often.
Thank you.
So we have an interesting commentary from
Jeff.
And, Jeff, you say that construction workers are attacking...
No, sir. There's vigilantes showing up in the middle of the night with chainsaws and sledgehammers, and they intimidate anybody sleeping in public.
When did you last see this happen?
3 nights ago.
And where did this happen?
In front of the Santa Cruz County Jail.
And how many folks were involved?
Involved with what?
Well, how many people showed up with sledgehammers and chainsaws?
They stole a car. They got driven down this way. People have these other people blindfolded so they don't know how they showed up here. Over, they supposedly came from Neeson Marks.
Did you confiscate their...
So-called experimental forest, Neeson Marks. There's something going on over there.
Fair enough, Chip. Anything else you want to report?
It's not a UFO.
I'll keep that in mind, and have a nice afternoon and now evening.
I'll keep you updated. They really blindsided us.
Thank you, Jeff. And it's a wet night on Pacific Avenue, but not raining. We have 4 performers, sort of, more or less, partially in, partially outside the grass dots. Yes. All right. I'd applaud. My hands are full. What's the name of your, for free radio, what's the name of your band here?
Well, we're all in, like, different bands, and one is Blue Summit and one is Pacific Drive, and we're both bluegrass bands.
And your name is?
I'm Dana Frankel.
And you are?
David Thiessen.
And you are?
AJ Lee.
The one and only AJ Lee. And Sam Camigi.
And who's the best? Who's the best?
Oh, definitely.
AJ.
Definitely.
There's some disagreement about that. So are you out here frequently?
We're visiting, but she lives in Santa Cruz.
We get together now and then on weekends to play music together.
No hassles from the police?
No. None. Not really.
Fair enough.
Edges, so, you know.
No hassle?
Play an accordion, go to jail.
Well, yes. Point.
Do you want to name yourselves something for free radio?
Cooper Street String Band.
Okay. Cooper Street String Band?
It's the Cooper Street String Band. It's that, you got Cooper it. Street. Cooper Street.
Or Sam Camigi and Friends. Sam Camigi and Friends is probably fine.
Sam Camigi and Friends. Thank you.
And we're beginning to run up against the clock. Here's another story from the San Francisco Chronicle. This one from a couple weeks ago, a Sunday Chronicle, October 30th. Family sues Oakland police, saying it was terrorized. An Oakland family was terrorized by police at home, quote-unquote, in December, and a subsequent cover-up by the Oakland Police Department only heightened the family's fear and anxiety, according to a lawsuit filed Friday in federal court. The lawsuit names the city of Oakland, 5 Oakland police officers, 4 men who were alleged to have been involved with the December incident, and 1 lieutenant who allegedly withheld information from the family. About 9:30 p.m. on December 7th, a man pounded on the door of Nemesio and Olga Cortez's home in Oakland's Redwood Heights neighborhood, according to the lawsuit and police reports. The man, later identified as Oakland Police Officer Cullen Faith, allegedly assaulted both Cortez's before being arrested in front of their home. A second man who ran up the couple's driveway and appeared to have a gun fled the scene and has never been identified. The lawsuit alleges that he, too, is an Oakland police official. Later that night, Oakland police twice visited the home to interview them, and the Cortezes say persuade them to downplay the incident, according to the lawsuit. The Cortezes say they didn't learn that the man who had tried to enter the home was a police officer for several weeks, and then only after Olga Cortez, an Alameda County probation officer, had heard rumors about him. The conduct was pretty outrageous the night of December 7th, said Attorney John Burris, who is representing the family. But the cover-up that goes to the integrity of the department. Is there any integrity in the Oakland Police Department? Well, that's another sort of a profound question, or maybe not so profound. Officials with the Oakland Police Department and the city attorney's office did not respond to requests for comment late Friday afternoon. The